Welcome to a very special episode of One Man Clapping. I am the one man coming to you direct from the bunker with another installment of Not All Heroes Wear Capes. In this series, I get to speak to individuals in our fabulous hobby who have, perhaps, contributed slightly more than the average person, and today is no different, though I suspect there will be objection to the term heroes, and I'm prepared to be corrected in case either of these ambassadors of board game culture actually do, in fact, wear capes. Welcome to the show, Mark Bigney and Michael Walker of So Very Wrong About Games.
Hello.
Thanks very much for having us. Slightly more than average is possibly more effusive praise than I'm accustomed to, but my mother would probably say it's about right.
Excellent. I was going to say that was a great way to explain my weight.
Yes, we're talking water displacement now. What, slightly more than average. How's your Saturday treating you, gents?
Great so far. Saturday is the day that we stream, so I always enjoy Saturdays.
And what did you stream today?
Today we streamed Rebirth by Reiner Knizia and Tirnog, an Irish card game.
Excellent. And so I guess just a little bit of a history for the listeners is how this came about. One Man Clapping's just hit its six-month mark. Congratulations to me. Thank you very much. It's amazing. But in October last year... Thank you. It's a big deal, isn't it, when you get your first 6 months under your belt?
The overwhelming majority of podcasts, my understanding, is do not last past 3 months. So 6 months is an accomplishment.
And I can understand that, because it seems like a good idea at the time. And then you start and you get to that 3 or 4 month mark and you go, this is actually like having another job.
Yes, very much so. I say that I'm a failure in retirement.
So this came about because I had a very clear notion when I launched One Man Clapping last October of how I wanted to spend my first year. And in that first year, I wanted to reach out to a number of individuals in the hobby, podcasters, designers, distributors, who I felt had made a meaningful difference in one way or another. And So Very Wrong About Games was definitely on that list. It was up at the top of that list. And I reached out to you gents in October last year with an email, which is obviously the only way we can reach out to people we don't know these days. And I sent the email and said, hey guys, this is what I want to do. And Mark, you wrote back and said, it sounds really great, but there is no way on God's green earth that we can make that happen, because you guys were going through some really tough times at that point. So then a touch base.
Cover that, Walker. That's,
I was going to say, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't remember anything.
Oh, well, we'll come full circle back to that. But then I reached out in December, or it was January, and I said, hey guys, remember me? I'm the dude you don't know in Australia who wants to take up an hour every time. Can we maybe look at this? And you went, yeah. Yeah, we can do that. And so we actually scheduled this for February. We had it locked in for February. There was a date, there was a time, but unfortunately I can't math. And we, this is the royal we, because I did the math. I wasn't expecting anyone to check my math. That's not a fair assessment of the situation. But we, the royal we, got the math wrong, and I ended up standing you gents up and leaving you sitting in Discord. And I basically got up Sunday morning to find a message saying, oh, hey, we're here. And it was awful. It was an awful day in One Man Clapping world, because I thought, oh, shitballs, I have absolutely wasted this gent's time. But here we are. We have made it. We're all at the same table. Well, digitally, we're at the same table. And we're here for a great chat. So my thanks, gents, up front. I just want to say thank you for your time. Thank you for what you do. And I just want to tell your story.
Sure.
All right. So I guess the first thing I don't have... Like, this is not a tit for tat interview. I have a few things that I'd like to ask about, but I guess what I want to start with is, what was your first board game memory? So this is, I guess, individually, like, what was your very first board game memory as board gamers? Mark, you want to go first?
Sure. I did not have people to play games with other than my mother. My sister and my father were not particularly inclined to play games, and I didn't have any other friends that did. My earlier memories focused around chess, of all things. Like many young children, I was exposed to chess. That was the kind of thing that you're supposed to teach kids, especially if you want them to be precocious or something of that nature. And I enjoyed the game, but tellingly, actually, for my future board game preferences, I was never really able to force the endgame. This very pretentious in that I don't really like positional abstracts very much as a rule, with a couple of minor exceptions. And you know, you can teach me how all the things work and everything, but as far as putting together a puzzle to solve for a solution, not my bag. This actually is also the story of how I almost failed sentential logic in undergrad, but that's another issue entirely. And so that's largely my history growing up, of not having anyone to play games with. So, you know, I was the kid who...
You couldn't play games... No, it's just, it's really interesting. You had no one to play games with, so you played chess.
Well, that's what I was exposed to. What, you know, it's kind of... It's a bit like miniatures gaming or role-playing. You play what is available. Yes.
Yeah.
And insofar as there was the ability to occasionally play something with my mother, that was chess.
Okay.
Because she knew how to play chess, and she taught me how to do that. She wasn't particularly interested in... I remember very, very... At a young age, I had a He-Man board game that I wish actually I could track down, because it had a moving top layer that rotated around a substratum, and the position, the space on the board actually relied on the combination of the top layer and the substratum. So perhaps there might have been something borderline interesting going on there, although it might have just been roll to move, whatever. I liked He-Man as a child, what can I say?
Yeah,
so just a smattering of chess, and mostly just a feeling of not being able to play anything. You know, later on, you know, 5 years later, I was the kid that had a whole bunch of D&D books and no one to play D&D with.
Sure.
And then I was basically out of the hobby until adulthood, when I stumbled back into it through Carcassonne. A couple of years after it was released, actually, I was in the West Coast, and I was in a comic book store, and I saw, you know, a very, very small selection, but of the newer hobby-type games from, at the time, it was Hans and Gluck and Rio Grande and Mayfair and those publishers. And after that, I was entirely hooked. So basically, it's a series of spurts of gaming for the early years of my life, and then upon attaining adulthood and the autonomy that comes with it,
and the wallet,
I've now been able to indulge my childish fantasies to their utmost.
Fantastic. It's not so dissimilar to my own story, to be honest. And Walker, tell us about your first board gaming memory.
I was going to say, mine's very similar as well. With my parents, they enjoyed Euchre, so there was a lot of Euchre being played, and then between my friends and I, there's a lot of just the pre, you know, commercially games like Paul Economy, which is the Canadian Monopoly, and Survive, and, you know, the stuff you'd get at department stores. And then my most early, like, sort of big gaming was role playing. And then that group would, you know, we'd role play for 3 or 4 weeks, and then we'd play, you know, some odd board game that one of them picked up for some reason, like Clay-O-Rama or stuff like that. And then at a convention, there was Space Hulk being played. And so I mailed a check to the United States of America, and they sent me my Space Hulk game. And that was sort of the beginning of it, because then we all got into Warhammer 40K.
Sure.
And so I ran a group, you know, where we had like 14 tables throughout my house and, you know, a bunch of people. And we play 40K and fantasy every week.
Fantastic.
And then they unfortunately switched to the tournament, you know, where, you know, they just, back in the day, you just played 40K against each other. Then the tournament scene became the big thing. And then it was almost overnight where the majority of my close friends just didn't want to do that anymore. And the game stopped. And the few board games that we were playing then just sort of took over. And that's what we did.
Fantastic. What was your role-playing game of choice, out of curiosity?
We just did normal D&D.
Normal D&D.
And with some paranoia mixed in every so often.
Fantastic. And so when did you two gents meet each other in the timeline?
Shortly after I moved to Kingston, which is now about, I'd say, 10 years ago. I just moved from Toronto because my wife got a job at the local university in Kingston. In Kingston, you either work, largely speaking, for the hospital, the military, or the university. And so she got a job at the university and we moved there. And very early on, I think, my first inkling that Walker may be the guy to talk to as far as to link in for local things is when I realized that he had a full copy of Sentinels of the Multiverse with all the expansions. I'm like, okay, well, that's a good sign.
And so where did you first meet, though? Like, you met when you got here. Tell me about the moment. Like, well, not the moment. It's not, was it love at first die, where you're running through a field of corn and there was Carcassonne in the middle of the field? I mean, did it start with miniatures? Just tease that out a little bit for me. How did you guys actually meet?
I believe our local gaming store had a gaming night where we met at first.
Yeah.
And then we just realized that the talking after the game was at least for me, was almost as fun as playing the game. And then it just advanced from there. And Mark sort of came into our group because that would be the one night I'd be playing almost every night. And so that was the one night I went there. And then he just got merged in with the other nights as well.
Nice. And so that was, yeah, sorry.
I think I more or less invited myself over to your basement. I think the first time we spent time together outside of the public game night was we played, I think, Hansa Teutonica in your mother's basement, as I recall. That might have been the first time.
Yeah, I'm the guy with the basement as well, so I understand people inviting themselves over, and we don't even mind. You know, we've got the space. If you want to invite yourself over, I'm that guy. So that was 2015, and then the first episode of So Very Wrong About Games was 2017. So how did you get from point A to point B?
That's all Walker's doing.
Okay, tell me about it,
Walker. True. Much like I just said, I found as though the talking after the game, and not just so like, you know, this is we do have a member that just likes to explain why he won. And that's not what I mean. I mean, just like, you know, what part of that game is like the same as other games? And what does this game do better? And why would we want to play this one over that one? And sort of like the after game chat is just as fun as the game itself.
100%.
And there was a bunch of other content creators already out there, and it seemed as though it was all about buy everything now. There was nothing about, you know, just talking about the games. It was all about we're going to talk about this game because we want you to buy it. It seemed to be just the constant push to get more games all the time.
Yeah. And so you just decided we're going to have a podcast. And so where was the first episode? Was that also recorded in your mom's basement?
Well, we talked about the idea, and then I had, like, the first family thing happened, and so it was sort of like I went away for a while, even though I had already proposed.
We did a pilot episode in my dining room of the place I was renting at the time. We just stuck a microphone between us, we sat down at a dining room table, and we did a test pilot episode about multiplayer conflict games, as I recall. It has never been released. I think I still have the audio file somewhere. The audio levels are garbage. That was not the point. It was a proof of concept rather than a technical test.
Sure.
And the strange thing is that Walker came up with a format. I didn't know it at the time, but I was in my head kind of drafting editorial policies. Not that there's a strict division of labor, but Walker came up with an initial format, and the initial format has been more or less unchanged from that pilot episode up till now, with a couple of minor alterations. And so it's been remarkably stable in terms of overall structure. I pride myself on never learning about anything or evolving. I think I peaked when I was 14. And so the podcast is definitely an indication of that.
Well, if you go back and listen to episode one, I would say you're definitely learning and evolving.
How dare you insult our early content?
It was not an insult. It was a clear and academic assessment. And I've only been doing it 6 months. If I go back and listen to my first episode, I can say there's a clear indication of evolution for sure. Did you remember episode one?
I think by the time... So Walker then immediately felt so good about the pilot episode that he left for 6 months. and went on a walkabout tour of Europe, the Middle East, and East Asia, as I recall. And when he got back, shortly thereafter, we recorded the early episodes in his bedroom of a basement ensuite that he was using of a mutual friend of ours. And right. I think we may have even erected some sort of crude blanket fort at the time. I don't remember, but I remember just sitting next to an ottoman. Oh no, it was an office chair with a missing back, I think. Walker, you can correct me if I'm wrong.
No, this all sounds good. I believe I think they had like glass doors. We'd cover up the glass doors because I knew the sound would reflect badly off of that.
Man. Oh yeah, the glass doors, yeah. Yeah, there was an office chair with a back missing. We put the microphone on that and we would just sort of squat around it as though it were a campfire. We did that for a little while, and then Walker rented a room from another mutual friend of ours, and we recorded a few episodes there. And then eventually we settled on the Great Blanket Fort. Walker built a blanket fort in his basement, and that has considerably lessened the burden on my end because I do the editing. And so since then, the the audio levels have mostly been dialed in with a couple of exceptions. And but I that must have been, I don't know how many episodes deep that was in, but eventually Walker built a solid top tier blanket for it out of moving blankets.
Fantastic. So in that first episode, because I had not listened that far back as a listener, I'm probably, I don't know, 3 or 4 years back, I decided yesterday in anticipation that I would listen to episode one. And look, the format, the first thing I got to the end of it, I'm like, well, that's the same show. It's literally the same show. But you did make a commitment in that show, Mark. I don't know if you remember. And I don't know as a listener and consumer of your content, the end result, I can't recall. But you in that show said, Walker, I'm going to get you over the line and make you love Sidereal Confluence. So
I now have more information about why Walker doesn't like Sidereal Confluence.
Right.
And so I do think I'm going to have to abandon that commitment. Fortunately, actually, we're discussing our upcoming, we're going to be having a very, very small convention in Kingston in July.
Yes.
And the listeners are rabid for Sidereal Confluence. And so probably the final triumph over Walker's reticence will just have to be the acknowledgement that he's going to be co-hosting a convention where Sidereal Confluence is played more or less around the clock.
Look, it's not about me, but I will tell you a very short Sidereal Confluence story because I really like Sidereal Confluence. I'm a chef by trade, and so everything in my house is food, food, food. I've got 4 fridges and a beautiful kitchen, and I've got stuff everywhere. And so we were playing Sidereal Confluence, and I think there were 6 of us playing, and it was right down to the last round, and I needed a trade to go through to win the game. And so I was actually negotiating food ingredients on top of the cubes, boutique food ingredients that I had in my pantry on top of the cubes, which caused the Dustin, who I was playing against, to basically capitulate the game for these gourmet food ingredients. And it's gone down in the annals of history as the greatest Sidereal Confluence trade that we've ever done. It was hilarious, and it was one of those tabletop moments that we'll all remember forever. It wasn't about the win so much because I tell people I like to win, but I love to play. If I don't win, I just move on. I just love to play. But it was one of those moments in gaming that we still talk about. It was absolutely fantastic. So,
and yet you were moved to gastronomic bribery for a victory.
It wasn't bribery. It's negotiation. I was sweetening the deal. It's a negotiation game.
Sure, much in the same way that someone who hands over their lunch money to a bully is negotiating the release of their head from a headlock. Yeah.
I like this idea, Mark. I think I might actually join in that convention game, and maybe I'll have the key to the bathroom.
That's right. That's right. That's right. And you're just pouring coffee after coffee after coffee at the table, Walker, and eventually someone's going to need that key. And
exactly.
But it's one of those one round only. They get the key for one round. They don't get to keep it. You got to get it back.
Keep in mind, for those of you who haven't played, Sidereal Confluence is a game that has been aptly described by its designer as a competitive game where whoever cooperates best wins. And yet, despite that, I'm now hearing that you can get apparently quite cutthroat. I like playing as the charitable whales. So all of this is news to me. I just like making making deals happen. I actually recently played a game of Sidereal Confluence where one of the softest spoken, most generous guys I know turned into an absolute bully the moment the game started. We would be engaged in negotiation. I say, oh, so I see you have some excess green cubes. And he's like, yeah, I want your white cubes. Give them to me. I'm like, yeah, sure. I could give you white for green. He says, no, 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 no. Give me your cubes. Well,
this is not how the game works.
No. Give me the cubes. It was so weird.
Yeah. So
I didn't recognize him.
Following on from that, what's your favorite swag moment or in history? How many years is it now? 17. So that's 8 years you've been doing the podcast. It doesn't have to be a podcast moment, but as the ambassadors of swag, what's your favorite moment where you've...
You go first, Walker.
I'm trying. I'm thinking.
That's okay. I can edit out Dead Space. I'm good at that.
Walker's answer is probably the last time Mark shut his den mouth.
I listened to an episode and I wasn't interrupted for like 4 seconds. That was the greatest.
Yeah,
I think it's mostly just the feedback we get from the listeners, right? When... I think I know this isn't the first one, but I think it might have been the biggest one. There was all these giant fires in LA this past winter.
Yeah, I remember.
And so Mark had the great idea, fantastic idea of sending out games to people who were affected by the fire, who lost their gaming collection and had, you know, that one Grail game or one special game that they wanted back, and that we would go out of our way, Mark would make trades or whatever it took to get people the games that they wanted. And before anyone even asked for something, we had several listeners also offering up their collections to give away to these people. It was just such a feeling amazing. Of like, we have the best listeners out there.
Yeah. Outstanding. And Mark, for yourself, I mean, you can't top that now. I mean, there's really nothing you could offer that is better than that ethically. So let's go with something selfishly.
Well, something happened recently that I'm actually not in a position to discuss, but it was related to that. I was, which is unhelpful in the context of an interview. I gotta say, it's gonna sound particularly vain, but whatever. It is vain. Winning the Golden Geek felt pretty damn good.
Yeah, I bet it did.
But I'll say primarily though, because it was voted on by the audience.
Yeah, so
it would have been one thing had it been a jury, or if it had been, you know, some collection of muckety mucks. But the fact that it was an audience poll that gave us the Golden Geek felt very, very gratifying.
So that was on my list. So let's touch on that now. So the Golden Geek, that was 2020, which is 3 years in, which is an amazing achievement. And unless I'm deranged, you can only do that once, can you? You can only win that once and then you're done. You can't win it twice.
Correct.
Yeah. So talk about that, I guess, that ride, you know, the Golden Geek ride, you know, because obviously there's a nomination and you get on the nominated list and then you get voted on. So was that a surprise, guys?
It definitely was. Like Mark said, when we put the microphone in his on his dining room table and did exactly what he said, it was a proof of concept. Can we produce a podcast that grows organically, that we will not pay for views, we will not do any sponsored content, we will put out a product on our own merit, and is that enough for it to succeed? And so when it sort of was proved that it could happen by that award, it was a great feeling.
Yeah, I bet. And the answer is a resounding yes. I mean, we're 8 years on and you're still making content and you're making good content and you're doing it without having to sell your soul, so to speak. You know, not naming names, but there are plenty of content creators out there that it's just... It's highest payer wins kind of thing. And that's remarkable. So I guess... Have you thought about signing an executive order overturning the limitations so that you can actually win it twice?
Yeah. Well, we wouldn't win it again if it were... Well, let's be frank. If it were Catch-as-Catch-Can, then probably some of the older shows or some of the network shows, you know, whether it's the Dice Tower, whether it's Shut Up and Sit Down, whether it's Heavy Cardboard. I mean, there's a whole bunch of established players who've been... A, doing this longer, B, have a larger audience, or both. And so, frankly, if it weren't for that policy, we never would have won in the first place. Let's be frank.
Yeah, well, there's sense in that. I mean, it means 22 years down the line, I might be in the running. So that's great news.
And but plus, I sort of like it that way, right? It brings to the forefront newer content creators. So you sort of get to know new people that are putting out stuff, right? It gives them a chance to get seen.
Yeah. All right, so I guess the natural lead-in from that is, can we talk a little bit about ethics? Because ethics are something that really underpin everything you gents do. And that's absolutely apparent in every minute, to the point where if you've made even the slightest error in one of your citations, that you'll correct yourself a week later. I mean, and I guess I want to pair with that accountability, you know, that you both recognize, and again... I'm talking as an outside observer. So, you know, this is, I guess, the assessment of somebody who's consuming your content, that you both, with willful abandon, recognize the ethics and accountability of what you do. And that starts with citing designers and artists, but disclosing relationships. You're very consistent in your dialogue around these sorts of things, you know. And I guess, where did that come from? On a personal level, because it's a wonderful thing, to be honest. You know, it just means that we know as consumers that we're getting your, and I'll come back to the very transactional word, the data. We're getting it untainted, or as untainted as possible, because it's impossible to have anything untainted by your individual perspective. But we're getting it as clean as possible. Does that make sense?
Well, it's what we aspire to. I and again, yeah, it's not it's less a question of removing some of the level of taint. It's more about being as transparent as possible.
For sure.
So that whatever. But
why is that important to you guys, Mark? Why is that so important to you?
Okay, well, part of it is my background is as an ethicist. I was trained as an ethicist, and I taught ethics for a while before I retired and moved to Kingston. But on top of that, when Walker first proposed the idea of doing a podcast, my first reaction was, to be frank, I don't listen to board game podcasts. I don't know what they're like. And he kind of suggested that that could be an asset. But yeah. I did spend the next little while listening to some of the major podcasts. And I don't want to name particular names, but there were some opportunities to learn by negative example. So whether it's being sponsored by a particular board game publisher, or whether it's a question of being somewhat indifferent to facts, or just thinking that it doesn't really matter, or being indifferent to attributing work, that just, it rubbed me the wrong way.
Yeah.
And I've since, to be fair, in the years since, I've become somewhat more, I guess I would say, I've tried to become a bit more broad-minded and acknowledge that there is different kinds of content for different kinds of environments.
Sure.
The analogy that I often draw to people who don't do anything about board games is, you know, you might identify a Pulitzer Prize-winning movie critic, and on the other end of the spectrum, there's someone like Entertainment Tonight. I don't know if you're familiar with that franchise.
Yep.
But like,
no, I grew up in Canada. Yeah,
advertorial content, right? Yes. Which is just like, what is X wearing? Who is Y dating? Stuff like that. And ideally, in a mature medium like film and television, when you go to a certain source, you know the kind of content you're expecting to get. You're not going to be expecting a sort of editorial, comparative, analytical presentation from Entertainment Tonight. In the same way, you're not going to expect much glitz and glamour, and you're not going to expect much gossip from the Pulitzer Prize-winning film critic. Now, this is not to say that one is necessarily the strict equivalent of the other, but insofar as board games is a very, very young medium, and it doesn't have as well-established rules or a sense of conduct or as clear delineation of those different kinds of media, I felt that it was unfortunate that fewer media didn't try to aspire to be a little bit more editorial, a little bit more critical in outlook. That's not to say that there aren't outlets doing that.
Sure.
It's just that there's less of a differentiation and there's kind of a morass. And it is expected, and this is the part that I really object to, it is expected that the same channel, and I'm sorry if this is calling anyone out, can expect to do a paid advertorial on Monday and then do a critical review analysis on Tuesday of even some of the same movers.
Yep.
That's the part where, as the negative example, but this cannot hold. And if we're going to get a little bit more mature as a board game medium, we're going to need a greater degree of transparency, a greater degree of disclosure, and one hopes from that a certain degree of accountability, although that part largely comes from the audience.
Yeah, look, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think having the disparate models out there, if you are inclined to, you know, pay attention, you know what you're getting. You do. You know what you're getting when you're watching someone and they've got ethics and accountability, and you're watching someone, as you say, who is, without naming names or calling anyone out, they're doing a rah, 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 paid, rah, rah, rah on the Monday. And, oh, by the way, we're going to pull this game apart, you know, critically and methodically on Thursday, but there's nothing in it. I couldn't agree more. And I think it's a fantastic way to sum up the situation. Walker, anything you want to add to that?
Oh, it's mostly, Mark said mostly it all, but I just want to add the main word that I use for the podcast is consistency.
Yes.
Not only in having it out every week, but having, like you said, the same morals, the same constant thing, because we have listeners that don't agree with anything we say,
mm-hmm.
but because we are constant, we stand up for what is right. And we keep the same level.
Well, we try.
They can use that. We try.
Yeah.
They can use that to gauge our criticism of something they like to understand why they would like it. Just because we are constant.
And they're still listeners, right? If they're
That's right.
disagreeing with everything you say, the podcast does what it says on the tin. It's so very wrong about games. Don't agree with us. And that's what I love is you basically say, don't agree with us. We don't care. We're here to give you our perspective, and it's very clear that that's your perspective. You know, it's I love Lacerda's. I absolutely love Lacerda's, and I know you gents aren't huge fans, and that's okay. We can still be friends. So I guess that consistency is a really important, I guess, underpinning character of the podcast, right? And one of the things that I want to drill down, not for hours and hours, but just for a few minutes, is you gents have very clear thoughts and opinions on diversity and equality, representation of minority groups, representation of women in gaming. And one of the words I used in one of our correspondences, Mark, was, you know, it's a courageous thing, you know, in 2025 to actually have a stance on these things. And you immediately disputed the notion of courage. And anyway, it doesn't matter. We go back and forth on that all day. But I think it is courageous in 2025 to stand up and say, we have a medium. We are here and we are delivering content to you. And we have a very clear stance on this. And it's because this is very polarizing, these sorts of things. And I guess, can you just unpick or chat a bit about where this is driven from? Because, like, as you say, Walker, it's about consistency. And I think that consistency has to use the same paintbrush across all sort of aspects. But as a father of three daughters, your stance on representation of women in gaming is really important to me. And I really get behind that. Like, I love playing mini games, but every time I pull a game out and it's got a barbarian woman in a bikini, I'm like, what are we doing here? So I guess I'm a fan of that stance, but it comes with a cost sometimes.
Well, Walker, very early on, articulated a very strong principle of growing the hobby. And I'd like to encourage him to talk a little bit more about that in that context.
Yeah, please.
Well, it's mostly just having everyone feel welcome. And I, you know, I'll come up with all these keywords. You know, we're in the board game industry. It's keywords. So the keyword here is time, people's time. It's very precious, not only to me, my own time, but other people's time. I know that sometimes people have such a 1 hour for their entire week to play a game. And I want that experience to be the best possible experience it can be. I want them to feel welcome. I want them to feel that they belong at that table. And when they're done, that they had a good time.
Yeah.
So to a certain extent, it's entirely selfish, right? When I look around the table, and I've been doing this for decades, and you see just a whole bunch of white cis dudes, I think, what's the half-life of this hobby going to be? Do we want to grow this? Do we want to have more people involved? Or do we want to have fewer people involved? And that redounds not just to the social group you have, but also to the designs you have. We've talked a couple times about the Zenobia Awards on the show, and the output of the Zenobia Awards, which seeks to reward and encourage the publication of and connect designers of color or who are treating on topics, lesser explored topics in history, and connect them with publishers and connect them with mentors. The output of the Zenobia Awards are fascinating designs that are utterly unlike a lot of what else is on the market. And the sense of homogeneity is toxic to a creative medium. And that's another thing that's kind of driven some of our editorial content over the years. Like, yeah, so this worker placement game, this auction game, this area control game, this area majority game, it's perfectly functional. It's fine. I had a good time playing it. How does it compare to the 50 other ones that I've played in the past 10 years? Sure. Right. And if you look at the output of these systematically underrepresented groups, they tend to, unsurprisingly, present different perspectives than the same voices we've been hearing for decades. And so selfishly, as a gamer, I very much appreciate the fact that I get a greater pool of people to play games with, and yeah, B, a greater pool of experiences to have. And the ultimately, pure selfishness alone can drive it there. And then there's just a more abstract editorial point, which is I'm always amazed at these historical wargamers who want to show up and either write a review or produce a podcast or whatever. And they said, let's just keep politics out of it. And I'm like, look, guys, and it's almost always guys, either these things are worthy of discussion or they're not.
Yes.
If they're not worthy of discussion, fine. But if they are worthy of discussion, we need to evaluate them as cultural products. And if we're going to have a discussion about a cultural product, can we not have the obvious, relevant, and interesting discussions about various 100%. Aspects of cultural products? 100%. It's mind-boggling.
Yeah, it's not a fictitious setting.
So shocking that these people want to spend so much time discussing something and yet leave out
they want to obfuscate the general nature of the entire incursion, so to speak, rather than dealing with it head on and talking about it, for sure.
It's a form of lobotomization.
Yeah.
It's the It's just, I want to devote a substantial amount of my life and a substantial amount of my thought to these things, but do it in a dumb way. I don't get it. It's utterly confounding.
In your podcast, you know, and we talked about this a little bit, I think, in the pre-show show, when I was talking about, you know, legal disclaimers and such, you guys are notoriously sort of cagey about personal details in the podcast, you know, using pseudonyms for friends and family, which I totally get and understand why. And there's kind of a veneer of a veil over your personal lives, but you weave enough tidbits in there that your listeners feel like we're still a part of it. You know, we get a little peek behind the curtain now and then. You know, it's kind of a blurry line, so to speak. And I guess, if that makes sense. And I guess the question, I know why it's important to me because I do a similar thing, but why is that line important to you guys?
Well, there's always going to be a strange parasocial relationship between creators and their audience. And it can be very alienating in a way to shout into a can and not get a whole lot of feedback. But at the same time,
I'm one man clapping. I just shout into it by myself. So I get that 100%.
But at the same time, from a listener perspective, and this is one of the reasons why even as long form content in other media is becoming vanishingly rare, it is the case that podcasts, often an hour, two, three, sometimes longer, are still very, very dominant in the marketplace. And the reason why is because they're shockingly intimate for the listeners. And they really do feel like they have this relationship. And I definitely feel that way about other podcasts that I listen to. I listen to episodes of your podcast. I feel like I know you, but I only know a version of you, right? I know the version of you that you're presenting on air, which may be consciously or unconsciously different from... Sorry, I taught a course on interpersonal relationship and interpersonal communications in college once. And ever since then, I've been thinking about Guffman setting all that aside. All these parasocial relationship things are fascinating. But getting back to your specific question about our own editorial policies, one of the things that I find maddening as a medical ethicist, which is how I was trained, was how little attention a lot of people, both practitioners and otherwise, pay to confidentiality.
Mm-hmm.
You hear confidentiality violated all the time.
Sure.
And early on in the podcast, I realized that I didn't have the permission of any of the people that I played games with to talk about them, repeat anything they'd said, or to attribute views to them. And so I'm like, oh, okay. And so Walker came up with the idea of referring to these people in the generic as Huey, Dewey, and Louie.
Yeah.
And eventually that metastasized into specific Huey, Dewey, and then two Louies. And then there needed to be other aliases for other people. And we actually have a section on our website called Dramatis Personae, where we just give fake bios of all the major players
sure.
in the elaborated swag universe. And it's just because I value their confidentiality. I don't want to use their names. I don't want to use their identities without their permission. And so it became vastly easier to give them pseudonymous and in many times exaggerated persona.
Yeah. Look, and I couldn't agree more. The Fox, who is the pseudonym I use for my beautiful wife, she is a lawyer, and it's not that she gave me any counseling on this, but I have an MBA. I understand ethics. I understand compliance and governance, and the gray area of going into open media and saying anything about anybody is a minefield. You know, it's an absolute minefield. Did you want to add anything to that, Walker? Because I've got a
follow-up. I was just going to say some of them listen to the show or know that people locally listen to the show, and I didn't want them to come in to the gaming sessions thinking that they couldn't say something or didn't want to do something because, you know, we're going to talk about it on the show. So just so they'd feel at ease, I think this was the better way to go.
Nice. So last year was a challenging one for you gents because it was around, I want to say, late August, early September. Walker, you had a stroke.
I did.
Have I got the timing right for that?
I always forget what the actual date was. When is Canada Day?
Well, Canada Day is July. Same
July.
It's always been for 100 years.
It was the day after Canada Day.
Okay. So when that happened, I want to say it's kind of like that veil or that curtain was kind of pulled back a bit, Mark, because you were still online, you were still broadcasting, and it was kind of, it would have been so easy to say, Walker's sick, Walker's unwell, right? But instead, it was total transparency on what's happening with Walker, right? Which was both shocking to your fan base, because I'm speaking from a personal standpoint, because I think Walker and I are not far away in years and age. But also, it was a very different sort of thing, whereas, you know, that thin veneer that has sat there and sort of semi-protected your personal life, because although Walker mentions Costco many times in the podcast, your podcast. He doesn't quite come out and say what he does. You know, he could be the national managing director for all of Canada. We don't know. All of a sudden, it's this is what's happening in our life, and it's deeply personal, and we're going to tell you not so much everything, but a lot more than you have. What was the driver between, I guess, behind that level of immediate transparency, gents?
Well, it was Walker's idea. Go for it.
Yeah, so tell us, Walker.
I don't know what Mark. I just think it was a large event. It had the potential of derailing the whole thing.
Yeah.
Depending on how, you know, I know, you know, you don't have any idea what's going to happen.
Yeah.
How much the recovery is going to be, what it's going to be like after the fact. And it was one of the things just to be upfront.
Sure.
Because it was going to interfere with the consistency.
And I can imagine it had the potential to end So Very Wrong About Games, but potentially, depending on how it went.
Oh, for sure. Because, like, no two strokes are the same. I could have had no voice or vision or any number of things.
In the immediate term, though, I definitely knew that although the possibility of having to abandon the podcast was there, in the short term, I wanted to keep it going, and I'll be entirely blunt. It's because I was going to be damned if, while Walker was recovering, I was going to cut off his source of secondary income.
Sure.
I mean, it's not a well-paying job, but it's a paying job. And I certainly wasn't going to, oh, Walker, you're sick. Oh, okay, well, I'll cut off your income now.
Yeah.
That was not going to happen in the immediate aftermath under my watch. And so I do have to stress that a large number of people, some of whom I'd never even spoken to, some of whom are relatively big names in the board game industry, crawled out of the woodwork and started offering all manner of assistance. I actually had a number of other guest hosts lined up whose services I kind of had to unceremoniously preempt because Walker recovered in about 5 hot seconds.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Borderline miraculous.
Yeah. So I guess it was... And I'm only reading between the lines for both of you, but we only got to see sort of Mark at the time. It was an incredibly stressful time. And I remember there, it was because I am a patron supporter, so I do get the unedited podcasts. It was the first swear word I'd heard in So Very Wrong About Games. Your cold open on that one was about 14 F-bombs.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah,
I don't even remember.
You're cold open. It was, I think, your first episode with, I want to say it was with Jimbo.
Yeah.
Maybe not real name. But it was your first episode, and you're cold open. You hit record, and you swore about 14 times. And I thought, you did. It was like, fuck, 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 fucking, fuck, fucking, fuck. That was your cold open on the Patreon Unedited podcast. And
so, for context, number one of the first bonus episodes I did, so I did this editorial on Phil Eklund, and I swore a lot in that. I swore a lot also when talking about the sad circumstance in which there was the discussion about which N-word the Italian designer used during that infamous interview. Anyway, so I have sworn before, and in real life, I swear all the time. And point of fact, I have a very, very narrow vocabulary.
Yeah,
most of it consisting of curse words. And the thing is, I don't take the Lord's name in vain, so I can't even boast a wide variety of swear words.
Sure. So, Walker, I'm just and one I guess follow up question to the stroke. Has it changed the way you engage with board games at all?
I wouldn't say very much overall. It really has affected my patience a little bit.
Yeah.
And it has affected my sleep an awful lot.
Yeah.
And so I have, like, you know, like when you don't have enough sleep, it's a little bit of brain fog, and I have a lot of trouble learning games because I have to have, you know, I mean, I have to be somewhat clear. If I don't know I'm, you know, bringing in the information, then I don't even bother trying. So if I didn't sleep properly, I just put it aside. I don't learn that game today, and I try again tomorrow and stuff like that.
One of the things that I loved as a consumer was that when you were back in the chair, you just owned the whole situation, Walker. Every little slip up of language, everybody just went, well, I've had a stroke. It was just, you know, and you had 400 stroke jokes for the first sort of 3 months in the chair. And it humanized the tragedy, so to speak, for everybody, right? As somebody who's listening, you know, we were all, look, I'd never met you gents, but as you say, you know, Mark, you have a one-way relationship with the voice, so to speak. And, you know, we were all deeply concerned. And to hear you kind of come out and be able to, you know, when you can start laughing at something that's happened, that you're starting sort of, I guess, the healing process, you know, of grief or whatever it is. It's a big deal, man. And just high five, Walker, honestly, just a real high five. Just delighted that you gents are going to keep making content for, you know, as long as you can. Coming, I guess, back to the content itself, can we talk a little bit about your review format? Because I think it's, being Canadian, I was born and raised in Winnipeg, Manitoba, sorry, not sorry, even a bad swag review is very Canadian. And by that, I mean, it's brutal honesty kind of couched in perfect manners, if that makes sense. You know, you guys are very happy to be brutally honest. If you don't like something, you will say it, but you'll say it in a way that's like, I didn't like it. You might like this flaming dumpster of hot trash, but I don't. When you're reviewing games, do you guys have a bit of a chat beforehand, or do you just go in cold? Because you've got a very odd couple relationship on air.
No, we definitely purposely don't talk about it beforehand.
Nice. Okay. So that's just the friendship bubbling over. You go back and forth because... You know, for example, Mark, you'll wax lyrical on something for like 2 to 3 minutes sometimes, right? Like you'll talk about a game and it'll be 3 minutes of basically, you know, saying this game's a flaming pile of it's a brown bag of poo flaming on your doorstep, but it's a beautiful way to say it. And then Walker, you'll come into the end and go, yeah, I really liked it. You know, that will be that's the summary of your review. It's like, I really liked it, you know, and then the obverse is true, you know. Walker will talk about a game that he's loved and he's played and he's talking about the theme and he's talking about the ins and outs and these mechanics and how great the game is. And then Mark, you'll come in with, huh. And we know when we get that, huh, that you're spending a good 20 seconds trying to work out how to tell Walker he's an idiot without telling him he's an idiot.
to a certain extent, there's, you know, non disputandum est and all that stuff, but also, to a certain extent, I appreciate the fact that you've correctly observed that I talk too much.
Sure, you talk too much, but it's from a vantage point of information, and you're not, as I said, you're not hitting that red button saying click here, click here, click here. You're giving an informed opinion. You've been playing games and assessing games professionally for 8 years, and... You know, we get your opinion, which might say, you know, this game is garbage. And we got Walker's opinion, which says it was so much fun. And so as listeners, we can go, well, I'm going to listen to Walker this time. I don't care that Mark's just told me 6 minutes of why I shouldn't buy this game. Walker likes it, so I'm just going to buy it. You know, that's... And can I say, you gents have saved me a lot of money, right? Like, Pledge of Indifference has probably saved me thousands, because I've been sitting there hovering over the pledge, and I listen to Pledge of Indifference, I go, yeah, no, they're right. No, yeah, no, yeah. So my thanks. You've saved me a ton of money.
That's good to hear. Yeah. I was feeling a little self-conscious about how for the past couple Pledges of Indifference, when we get to the section of the end where we talk about, okay, so what are we pledged for right now?
Nothing.
And the past couple of times I've been like, nothing?
I don't think
part of it. It's like, what kind of board game critic am I if I'm not playing for the games? Like, well, good to know that I'm saving people money.
You are. So I guess we're coming up on 8 years now. What's the main driver that keeps you guys going? Because as I said, I started a podcast 6 months ago, and at the 3 and 4 month mark, you go, this is a job. Like, this is, and it's, for the first year, it's like, it's, you get almost no feedback or limited feedback from anybody. You're vomiting out into the ether. And I do it because it makes me happy. You know, it's like therapy. I get in here and I talk to myself for an hour and 15 minutes and I leave and I feel lighter. And I have listeners all over the world, which is amazing and humbling. Oh my God. It's so humbling when you find out you got 17 listeners in Ukraine who are getting bombed and they're taking time to listen to your podcast. But what keeps you guys going? Where's the strength and impetus and energy still coming from after 8 years?
I think it's what Mark's been saying a lot recently, and that's like practicing self-care, like knowing when we have to skip a week, knowing that when we have to, you know, pull back and do less. Like when we were talking earlier in the show about, you know, the first episode, I kind of went back and I looked, and it's like we did a topic and a main game every episode for the first couple years.
Yeah.
And I have no idea how we did that. Yeah, I don't understand it. And then so thankfully, weird. we, you know, pulled back and said, this is just too much. And then we, you know, started rotating. And when stuff like that comes up, we see one of us is struggling or we're not feeling it that week. And we just know when to pull back.
Anything you want to add to that, Mark?
Well, the partnership helps a lot. I don't know how you do it.
Yeah.
But I only know how to do this with a partner. And that helps a great deal. And I remain consistently interested in what Walker has to say about things, despite my better judgment. And on top of that, I will say, you know, I mentioned before that in July we'll be trying for the first time to hold a very, very small convention. We were very fortunate to go to Shucks, Shut Up and Down, Sit Down Expo, two of the last years that they did it. And being able to meet people in real life that listen to your show.
Yeah.
Is among the most energizing experiences possible, even when they're telling you all the things they hate about it, which many people are willing to do. And it just contextualizes.
I might disagree with something you say. I don't hate anything you've got to say, gents. You know, it's,
Okay. Permit me a certain degree of narrative hyperbole when recounting these instances, but it manages to contextualize things because we are present for 100% of the production of the show and for 0% of the consumption of the show.
Sure. Yeah.
all that you have are numbers, and they're not even very reliable numbers.
No.
And so it can get very difficult to contextualize what it is that you're doing and understand that the impact that it has any impact on anyone's life. And being able to get every few years just in-person feedback from people that say, you know, I listened to the show. Thanks for putting out the show.
Yeah.
Even that alone is enough.
Nice.
And I'm hopeful to be able to have those opportunities every now and then. I mean, I should probably go to more conventions. Then again, I go to every convention to which I've been invited. But sure. There we have it.
So can we chat just briefly about Congrès, So Very Wrong About Games, Fun Times, I had to write this down, Good Vibes Only, Trans Rights, Are Human Rights, Board Game Jamboree.
Thank you for getting it right. Thank you.
Yes, I had to write it down. I don't make many notes for this sort of stuff, but I wrote that down word for word to make sure I got it right. So talk about that a little bit, because I can tell you, if I could get to Kingston, Ontario to play games with you guys, I would. But it's unless I drill through the earth, it's not going to happen.
Well, I guess,
how did it come about, gents? What made you decide that you want to host, I don't know how many it is, 150 people or whatever it is, and...
No. No, currently we have about 40, and okay. We might get another 20, maybe.
Okay.
No, very, very small. Mostly it was two things. First, exactly what I was talking about, the desire to have those kinds of in-person experiences and just be able to spend time with our listeners and get a sense of who they are and give them a chance to talk to us if they have anything they want to say to us. And the second thing is that most of the things that we've done in So Far Wrong About Games have been after at least a year or two of listeners harassing us to do something. And it's just something that listeners have been asking for. So sure. I think the least we can do is finally pony up and do it.
Fantastic. So I've got a very specific question about it because it's personal to me. Why are trans rights important to Swag?
I've been both versions of transhumanist for pretty much the entirety of my adult life. I think the only kind of legitimate humanism there is a transhumanism. I'm a Kantian. And anybody knows anything about Kant's philosophy, it's about respecting fellow people, as being ends in themselves, as being inherently worthy and deserving of moral respect. And that's about giving people the space to live life on their own terms.
Yeah.
And it's not that I value trans rights above any other form of fundamental human rights. It's just that trans rights are human rights, and they seem to be the ones under the most visible, relentless assault in the sort of North American political ecosystem. And independently of the fact that I have a number of trans and non-binary people that I love, as a transhumanist, as a Kantian, it strikes me as desperately offensive. And it's the kind of, very often pretextual, but it's the kind of rhetorical battleground on which we are fighting to give people the space to live life on their own terms. Because not to get too far afield, but make no mistake, bathroom bans, sports bans, all of these things are an assault on cis women as well.
Sure.
Because we know from data, from jurisdictions where these things have happened, the moment you start accepting these kinds of retrograde policies, thinking that you're just beating up on trans people, That is an open invitation and indeed in many cases a legal mandate for state-sanctioned investigation of people's gender presentation. Mm-hmm. And that does not stop with trans people in any way, shape, or form. And as somebody, for example, just as a minor thing, I retired when I was 34 years old so as to better support my wife's career aspirations. And I've had lots of jobs. I've quit lots of jobs. I've stumbled into very, very good jobs. And other than SWAG, the only job that I haven't quit so as to support my wife's career aspirations, the SWAG is it. It's the only one that I haven't had to quit for that. And that is not, I've faced a non-trivial amount of pushback because that's not a kind of quote unquote stereotypical masculine thing to do.
Sure.
And so that's like one millionth of the stakes of what we're talking about here. And it's an imposition on my own autonomy to not be able to live life on my own terms. And so that when I see struggle for equal rights, when I see the struggle for moral treatment of human beings, I cannot help but see, especially in this particular moment, that trans rights deserve a special pride of place. And so even though the title of the convention is kind of half a joke, that trans rights or human rights are not part of the joke.
Yeah.
And if anybody looks at that title and says, oh, that makes me not want to show up at the con, I say good riddance.
Yeah. So for context, my eldest daughter is transgender. So we have lived that bias, that social bias. We have lived that. It goes beyond discrimination into borderline hatred in society. And it's a very, very difficult thing for a group of people that all they want to do is live their life the way they want to live it. It has no impact on anyone else. None whatsoever. And absolutely. So, I absolutely got the subtext of the title. The title of the Congre was a little bit sort of smirking to one side, but at no point did I think trans rights for human rights was part of the joke, because I saw that as, well, that's swag being swag. That's the ethics and accountability and the diversity inclusionism. But I specifically wanted to ask about what was the driver for that, because my beautiful wife and I, my eldest daughter, Lou, she came out as trans. I think she was 14. And it was a terrifying time for her. It was a terrifying time for all of us. You know, it's like, what does this mean? And it's hard enough to go through without having to deal with everybody else's bullshit.
Yeah.
Okay. Walker, anything you want to add to that, Walker? Because Mark's had the soapbox for about 4 minutes.
No, he talks about the subject much better than I could.
Yep. Yeah. And Mark, did you want to bookend that with anything?
It's the fundamental struggle that every human person has to do. It's the act of self-creation.
Yeah.
The difference is I got to engage in the searing crucible of self-creation without a vast segment of the society spewing hate-filled bullshit at me.
Yeah.
And so
that's exactly right.
Yeah, the least that I can try to do is in some cases try to call attention to that. I mean, it's not primarily a podcast about social justice; it's more a podcast informed by social justice.
Yeah.
But on those occasions, it's nice to be able to highlight it when possible.
So, I guess one of the questions I did want to ask: do either of you gents, we're coming close to the end, so my thanks for your time. Do either of you gents have a board game bucket list?
It's mostly just some new stuff that came out last year that I couldn't get played.
Yeah, but like, I mean, if you could play
Shackleton Bases.
If you could play a game with a specific designer, or if you could experience a specific thing, is there anything on your to-do list that's like, well, my time on this planet is really finite. Is there something I really want to get done before I go?
Yeah, not really. I'm very like anti-celebrity.
Yeah.
So even like, you know, any like a game with a designer is just not for me.
You say that as a minor celebrity yourself. So
no, not even close.
Walker's the show. He's the big show.
He's the show, that's right.
Just the eye candy.
Just the eye candy.
It is, to follow up on what Walker said, it is so much easier for me to do my job the way I want to do it if I've never met designers.
Sure.
But that said, you are personal friends
with some designers. There's some you mention quite regularly on the podcast. But you're very
clear. Yeah, Eric Royce and Chris Cheslick. I became friends with them before I became a board game critic.
Sure.
That's just baggage that I bring in from bring into the job from before I started the job.
Yeah. Well,
I have a great bucket list. I want to get the number of games in my house to below 100.
Oof.
That's
below 100. How far are you away from that goal right now?
I don't 300? Want to say. I don't know. I used to have a count. I don't have a count anymore. There's games everywhere.
Yeah.
That's ambitious, Walker.
Right. I know.
So, look, without getting too philosophical, you know, it's one of my favorite quotes of all time is, you know, a society grows great when old men plant trees in whose shade they know they shall never sit. What does Swag's shade look like?
Sorry, I can't help but think of shade in the sense of drag queen.
No, oh, that's... you go where you want to go. That's, you know, it's what is the legacy? What is it you guys want to leave behind? When this is all done, when the end game scoring is done and you've gone around the Kramer track, what does Swag's shade look like? Does that question even make sense?
I would say integrity. They always held to their morals except for that last year where they sold out everything.
Perfect.
That is amazing.
If those incoherent yabos can have a podcast, maybe I can too.
You know what? And to be honest, it's guys like you, and there's an Australian crew that I was to called Borgia Barbecue, and they have a completely different vibe, but they're fantastic. And it was really listening to guys like, you know what? Like, I can talk the ass off a fly. Like, I can absolutely... And I can talk to myself. I can. And, you know, I thought, well, I'll give this a go. So you have had that influence, 100%, gents, you know, even if it's just one. I guess in is there anything you'd like, any little story, any little tidbit you'd like to tell at the end of this about your Swag journey together that I've maybe not thought to ask?
I think I do want to share with the world the story of how committed Walker is to his little bits. Because knowing Walker is kind of like on a never-ending roller coaster of irony and trolling. And I think it's important that the world understand this. We, you know, we talked a lot about Walker's stroke. The day after he had a stroke, I texted him about doing Pledge of Indifference later that week. And that was about 2 or 3 days later. And he said, sure, no problem. I'm in the hospital, though. And I said, oh, what's wrong? Is something wrong with your mother? And he says, no, just had a stroke. And this was...
That's how you got the news? This is the way he told me. Jesus this is the way he Christ, told me Walker. I'm not going to be able to make it. I've just had a stroke.
No. He didn't even say that he wouldn't be able to make the recording of the thing.
Wow.
Just even the day after, as he was recovering in the... I believe at the time you must have been in the ICU... You're like, ah, here's an opportunity. I'm a get 'em good.
Oh my God. That's horrifying.
speaking of horrifying, this is not gamer related, so it probably just you can cut it. It's just because it was a story that I was telling some people today. It was karma. It got back at me because this is the night of the stroke. It happened in the morning. So this is the evening. I'm not sure what time it was because, you know, I'm in this room with several other people and they brought in this gentleman that either had a drug overdose problem or a concussion, and they had to keep him awake, and they were having trouble keeping him awake. And the funny part is that his name was Michael as well. So there I am lying in bed with my newly acquired brain damage and heavy medication, and all I could hear was, Michael, wake up, Michael.
Oh my goodness.
Michael, wake up. And I don't know if you can understand the psychological damage that does to you when you like you wondering if you're awake or alive or what's going on. It was sure. Quite horrifying.
It shouldn't be funny, but it is.
Yes, exactly.
So I guess the last question I'll ask, and this is it's a personal one. As a chef, when chefs get together at the end of a night or we've had a few drinks, whatever the thing is, we play last meal. If this was your last dinner, what would your last meal be? And so on the podcast, I like to play last game. So for whatever reason, it doesn't have to be dark and dismal, but you can only play one more board game and then you are literally done. You can't play another one. What would your last game be? Doesn't have to be your favorite game. Doesn't have to be, but what would your last game be? You can only play one more. You get one more board game experience. Walker, we'll go with you first.
Well, I feel as though my Hansa Teutonica, I'm just going to say that. I think it's been the most rewarding game that I've ever played.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's the best game.
No, it doesn't have to be the best. It's just you get one more experience for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Yeah, Hansa Teutonica, Mark?
I'll just be boring and go with my favorite game, Tigris and Euphrates.
It's not boring if it's your favorite game. Mine would be Voidfall. You could ask me, I wouldn't even think about it. Voidfall. I'm going to play Voidfall one more time. You could ask me 1,000 times. It's not boring. If that's the answer, then that's the answer, right? It's not boring.
Need to play Voidfall again soon.
I had a game the other day, and it's still amazing. Gentlemen, my humblest thanks for your time. You didn't know me from, in Australia we say, you don't know me from a bar of soap. I don't know what that means. It's an Australian saying. You don't know me from a bar of soap. When we started this, you didn't know me from a bar of soap. And I just have delighted in the last, what is it, hour and 10 minutes, and getting to know you more, getting to hear the details and coalesce the story all in one place. Eternally grateful for your time. It's humbling that you've spent time. To hear that you've listened to my voice is equally humbling. So my thanks for your time today, gentlemen. Keep being amazing. Keep Swag is one of the highlights of my week every week. I look forward to it. If it doesn't drop on time on Tuesday, I get grumpy. And I don't really. I do look for it first thing. And have a wonderful day with whatever you're doing the rest of the day.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks for invite. Break. Echoes pound and hearts they quake.